Oh, everybody, I am excited. This is going to be an excellent conversation tonight. Oh, we're going to get extremely detailed in a bunch of different things because we're talking about X-Men, the animated series. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to your new favorite show, The More You Nerd. And this month, we are talking about the 1990s X-Men animated series going all the way back to its beginnings in 1992 before the new X-Men 97 series on Disney Plus hits us later this month. And boy, I am excited. I am Drew, and I need the Cyclops to my Wolverine. Miles, how are you, friend?
I'm doing pretty well, bud. I am very excited. It took all my effort not to make some crack like using a pun on your name and calling you Drew Blee.
that would have been a good
one. I literally had like written out so many zingers, and I was like, I'm just not gonna do it.
It would only work if you used them in the Wolverine voice, like Cajun, settle down, gumbo.
Yeah, it's funny because like I. In your memory, like Wolverine has a specific voice, and when you go back and watch it, it doesn't quite line up with like my memory of the voice.
Oh, it does for me easily.
Well, no, it sounds. I think because like there had also been some video game stuff that used like in the fighting games used I think a different voice actor, and I think it was just a little gruffer and a little less. Hammy, and I think I just kind of like blended those two together. This cartoon is this, I mean, one, it was a game changer along with Batman the Animated Series, and I would say more so in terms of popularity than Spider-Man the Animated Series, despite the fact that Spider-Man was also very popular. This is, I think, one of the most iconic series of the 90s.
1,000%.
Yeah, and this is also the height of X-Men's popularity. You know, the launch of the standard X-Men title that had Jim Lee on art launched, I think it was 1991, which is where most of these looks come from. Like this set the standard of like show. What people think of the X-Men.
This show is 90s. Oh my gosh, it's 90s. Can I share something I just learned about Wolverine's voice?
Sure.
So Cal Dodd voices Wolverine, and at least in this original version. Born in Dublin, Ireland, his family moved to Port Dover, Ontario, when he was a kid. So he's both Irish and Canadian. Which is why, because I noticed in watching this, he's got a pretty good Canadian accent on Wolverine. Like Wolverine sounds very Canadian in this series.
And you know, it says he voiced him in Marvel vs. Capcom, so maybe it was just the way that chip sounded or something.
Maybe. But he is the brother of vocalist Rory Dodd, who is the duet voice on Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Really?
Yeah.
That is, I think that's very cool.
That is very, very interesting. Anyway.
I would imagine you, like myself, have a long history. And from what you've told me, this probably would have been your real introduction to the X-Men, right?
Oh, this was the only thing I knew about the X-Men for years until... Golly, I'm not sure I got heavily ensconced in X-Men lore until much, much later, because I wasn't really a big long-time listeners know I wasn't a big comic books kid. I wasn't a big comic books person until we started doing this show. And I've since gone back and read a ton of comic books. But I wasn't a comic book person. I knew about stuff. And of course, when we were in late high school, college, the X-Men movies started coming out. But every time I would look at the X-Men movies, like, my brain goes back to the animated series looks for things. Yeah. Like, especially Cyclops. If Cyclops doesn't have hair poking out of the top of his head, he looks weird to me. Despite the fact that that has been 90% of Cyclops' looks have had the full head covering.
I'm not gonna lie. I hate the head covering. I like the 90s, you know, visor, the head's coming out, the hair's coming out. I mean, look, when Jim Lee redesigned these characters for the X-Men comic relaunch, which was not really realized from the launch, because Uncanny X-Men was still running. I mean, this was a seismic shift in terms of, like, the X-Men were getting popular, but once this hit, and that comic was, I think, had set the record for, like, best sales for a very long time. I mean, he just redefined what the X-Men looked like. And these looks have been iconic ever since. I mean, to this day, I don't care what they ever do with Wolverine, that yellow and black / blue costume is Wolverine to many people. Gambit has largely been unchanged since he appeared.
Does Gambit even have another costume other than the one that he shows up?
Yeah, no, he's had prior to there was a period during the Uncanny X-Men where he had that yellow and blue outfit and just put his coat over it.
And I think now he's gotten rid of the, like, black half face mask thing.
He probably has. Rogue, I mean, that classic look.
Iconic.
At this point, Jubilee has largely remained unchanged. They sometimes, you know, modernize her look. Jean Grey doesn't often wear whatever that suit is.
And I remember that
Beast so much that
let's talk about Jean Grey, because I remember thinking Jean Grey was the coolest back in the day, and I watch it now and I hate that costume. I think that costume is bad.
So it is bad in a lot of ways. Part of it is, and this happens a lot in this show, is I don't know what the deal was with coloring certain things. I don't know if there was a problem, but when it came to oranges and tones that were close to a peach flesh tone, they goofed, because half the time Jean looks like she's butt ass naked. And as does Sabretooth, even though in the comic book costumes, that's like her costume's like blue and orange, like a prominent orange. It's not a flesh tone.
It's, you
and,
know,
and then this, in this series, it is also Jean is pretty. And the weird thing is she's pretty useless in this season.
I remember her being a much bigger deal, but I also. Like, it's kind of, honestly, it's kind of weird. As we get into talk about these episodes, I think it's the pacing. Oh, not even the pacing. I think the pacing of the show is fine. Just the cast that seems to come and go. I don't know. It's very, very interesting. But well, let's get started talking about this show. So this show was actually in production or in planning from as early as 1989. And that's when the Pride of the X-Men pilot got made. And I've seen this pilot.
I have too. I used to own it on VHS
with Australian Wolverine.
there were so many lines from that pilot that have stuck with me to this day. Like, and they're really random. Like, it's okay, little one. Colossus like rain. Like, dumb lines like that. Where Kitty Pride is kind of the Jubilee, the kind of audience entry character.
Which she would have been at the time.
At the time, absolutely. It's honestly a fun little pilot. The style is very much like what the X-Men arcade game is based off of.
In fact,
because
I think they
use that team, because you got Storm, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Dazzler, Cyclops.
I'm pretty sure they use the same voice cast for the audio clips in that game too. There's a podcast I listen to that uses the phrase X chicken, which is from that game, which is Magneto calling them X chickens, which is just a ridiculous thing to say. But as we
sadly, that pilot bombed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody's favorite Canadian superhero is weirdly Australian. what are you going to do? But moving forward, Margaret Loesch, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name. She was a champion of that pilot back in 89, but she became the head of Fox Kids, the Fox Children's Network, and contracted 13 episodes of The X-Men in 1990. Of course, they would finally release in 92. Animation takes a while, gang. Contracting Saban Entertainment, of all things. Saban
was synonymous with Fox Kids in the early to mid-90s.
Who never heard of Saban? Nobody's. What has Saban ever done?
Well, at this point, I'm not kidding. A lot.
Have they not done Power Rangers?
This is October of 92 is when this this pops up in on Halloween in 1992. Power Rangers did not appear until the next August.
Oh, wild. I can completely forgot that this beat Power Rangers. Interesting.
Yeah. So this is before, this is kind of, I think, what kind of helped him get Power Rangers in a sense, because he had the success of this block.
Interesting. Let's get down to it and talk about these episodes, and we'll talk about kind of the cast as it kind of comes in. So we, of course, start with the two-parter, the opening two-parter, Night of the Sentinels, where we are introduced to Jubilee, as she is an early 90s
mall kid.
Does a mall chick eat chili dogs? Is that what she says at one point?
A lot of hip phrases written by people who have not probably talked to a teenager since 1981.
Yes.
Voiced by Claire Redfield herself, Allison Court.
Oh my God, I've never put that together.
Yeah, that's Claire Redfield from Resident Evil 2. Yeah.
Oh man.
I
don't usually get taken voices taken by surprise. That is absolutely wild. I love that.
I do too. Jubilee's long been one of my favorite characters, to the surprise of probably nobody. And it started with this show. I love this two-parter because it gives you everything you need, really.
It does. I think it's kind of middling in the first part. It's just because they don't know, you don't know what's going on. Also, I think it's hilarious that all of the female characters in this show and Scott Summers, Cyclops, have at least one set, and Wolverine, everybody has a set of an X-Men costume and a set of like streetwear.
Yeah,
the only two people that don't
are Gambit and Jubilee,
who's just got the same yellow long coat every time,
right,
which conveniently is an X-Men color, and Gambit, who looks completely wild.
There is a couple moments where I think in the Genosha episode, I think they are dressed differently, even Jubilee.
But Gambit is still not. He's still wearing his costume all the time.
I love Gambit. He's long been one of my favorite characters, and that really started with this show.
He's great in this show because he's just got so much like charm and swagger that a lot of other characters are not allowed to have. Also, his eyes are black and red, and they never explain it. I guess he's a mutant, so that's just how his mutant powers manifested.
And I mean, like you, I in my mind's mind, like I remember the Scott, like Jean always doing that, but like I thought she was a lot cooler than she ends up being in the first season. I know she picks up a little bit, but the character that I forgot a lot of outside of just saying Suga was Rogue. And Rogue is essentially a young Blanche Devereaux with mutant powers. Like, she is like constantly thirsty.
You look as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs.
All of her little Southern non sequiturs crack me up. But I mean, it also makes sense for the character because she's been denied human touch for so long. Yeah. So like it makes sense. But like every time she either hits on somebody or has some little like comment to say, it cracks me up. I think she is such a fun character.
Totally. She's might be my standout character of this first season. She is given some of the most to do.
She really is, and I forgot about that, because the person who I thought was in this, at least this season, a lot more than he is Beast, who was in prison the entire season.
Beast is arrested in the second episode, and he and Charles decide that he's just going to wait and stand trial, because that's how they're going to prove that mutants are peaceful. And we encounter him in different, in weirdly different jails over the course of the series.
Yeah, anytime they go into a jail, Beast just happens to be there for no reason.
Because this they also get around the country and around the planet so fast in this show. It's a little wild. But yeah, Beast is just, you know, he's always there. I like Beast a lot with his sort of, you know,
it makes sense they got Kelsey Grammer to voice or to play him in the live action, because it just sounds like someone's doing a Frasier impression.
Definitely.
Like when he starts reading Shakespeare and he's like, the bard. And I'm like, oh my God.
I can catch up on my Dostoevsky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So how do you want to go about this? Do you want to talk about some episodes that like you really dug? I know we said we wanted to focus on
Night of the Sentinels. let's generally talk about the stuff that we cover that we aren't focusing on, because we didn't really talk about the two-parter is interesting. You find out that Jubilee's foster parents, one of them is a complete narc and sells this girl out to the mutant registration.
Narc because they buy into like the propaganda, like they're just stupid, they're not hateful, like they do love their foster kid, like it's just that he's a moron. Like believes the mutant registration thing is like, oh no, they're just like, you know, we're gonna look good because of this, and they're gonna like make sure she's safe. And it's like, nah.
He also rats him out when the X-Men come to visit,
and then immediately rats on himself.
Yeah,
the dude loves to snitch.
Yeah, so you know, and we do have the introduction to the Sentinels, which are of course a big deal for this season. Which, by the way, Miles, we've talked offline about this, but can we just talk about how interconnected this show is?
I'm still surprised, because I remember watching this, you know, every Saturday at 11. And I remember thinking they were kind of like, there were a couple episodes that were connected as two-parters, but like I remember thinking that each episode was like standalone, Mutant of the Week. And this thing is a one continuous story.
Yeah, it really, really is. And it makes me glad that I didn't get a chance to finish the 13th and final episode of this season, which I will probably do before I start on season two. But I'm kind of glad we didn't skip around, because there's just so much that leads into this episode. Like, the third episode is all about Magneto breaking Beast out of prison, which only happens because Beast is in prison as of the second episode. Sabretooth is a whole big deal, and the Sabretooth story lasts over several episodes too, but just kind of in the background and not main plots. Like, it's all...
The Cold Vengeance episode is one I had on VHS. I don't know if I got that from Pizza Hut or not, but the whole, like, you'll die cold and alone. At least I won't have to listen to your flapping mouth anymore. Has been, like, burned into my memory. Like, I have watched that episode so many times.
I like Wolverine in the show quite a bit. We get a bit with the Morlocks. We get when Sabretooth is captured, you see Professor X trying to dive into his mind. And during that diving in, you just see flashes on screen of Weapon X members, including Deadpool and the dude with the crazy mask whose name I can never remember.
Maverick.
Maverick's a wildcat, isn't he?
Nope.
That it's Maverick.
He was part of Weapon X.
I'm probably getting him confused with somebody else. Anyway.
I mean, there also probably is a character called Maverick. You're thinking of Grifter.
I'm thinking of Grifter. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Anyway. And that's the other thing, is that there's so many moments that are just like, just wild, like Slave Island, which is a terrible episode name, but it's all about Genosha, which which was a big deal in the comics, right?
Every single one of these episodes has a comic book counterpart. Like, almost every single one is a version of a comic book story. Now, there are a couple. I don't remember if Sabretooth had been captured prior, but there was a period after this in the 90s or early 2000s where Sabretooth was captured, or like kind of, I guess, a guest of the X-Men. Because I remember Joe Madureira did the artwork, because I know he and Psylocke had a big battle. And I think that's why she had the little thing on her eye forever. But like the Unstoppable Juggernaut is based off of an old X-Men comic, like X-Men number 12.
The Juggernaut, the Morlocks,
obviously based specifically. In fact, the whole fight is like the cover of an issue. Enter Magneto is X-Men number one. Like, yeah. There's so much stuff that has been taken from the comics, even if it's not one for one. Like, it's, if you were an elder comic book fan, which is why so many people have such a fondness for this show, like, and the same with, you know, the Spider-Man one as well, but like, this thing was taking comic book stories and making them into animated episodes. Well, it wasn't just an X-Men cartoon, it was the X-Men cartoon.
And this is where I want to say, like, that Slave Island episode with Genosha, you've got named well-known mutants in that mm-hmm. episode that yeah. don't even have lines. Like,
yeah,
North Star.
Yeah.
North Star and his sister are both in there. They don't have a single line. Is that Warpath? Is that his name?
Yeah. Are you talking about
the Native American guy? Yeah. You've got is it Sunfire? Sunfire.
And Sunfire is called by name at one point.
He is. This is where we get the introduction to the Blob, who's a big part of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, which is not named that in this show. Like, there's so many background characters to the point where there are some episodes that just take the time to just, oh, here's a whole Colossus subplot in this episode that is completely useless and meaningless, but it's just to have Colossus on screen for a minute.
It's great with the Juggernaut episode, and also the whole, like, you Americans are crazy. Yeah. Because the poor guy is just trying to, like, do his job and go home. Yeah. But yeah, that is one of the fun things about this show, is you will see, like, full in costume from the comics characters, even when they're introduced. Like, at a certain point, Bishop is introduced. He has the X on his belt that he has in the comics, even though he is not an X-Man at that point in time.
Actually, it looks like they've changed it a little bit on his sleeve. It's got like a weird little, like, eagle behind it or something.
And then Cable has an X as he does in the comics, even though we don't know who he is. And in the first season, he is just some guy who is looking for Dr. Adler, that we later find out is Apocalypse.
Well, he also has this whole backstory where he was part of the Genosian leader's revolutionary army. And
which is wild, because like, half of X-Force is in the Genosha slave camps. Like, Domino's there, Feral's in there. I think I saw Cannonball, or Cannonball might be on a different episode, but he pops up at some point.
Cannonball doesn't
on
show
a TV screen.
Cannonball doesn't show up until the Alpha Flight episode, I think.
No. Not Cannonball as a character, just like there is a shot on the TV or something, or a computer screen or something, and it is 100% Cannonball.
Wild. Again, there were characters all over the place in this. I think the arc, when talking about the cure, the mutant cure, I was interested to see that play out. I weirdly remember Beast being the one that was most interested in the cure and not Rogue, although it makes perfect sense for Rogue to be the one interested in the cure.
I don't remember if this show does the legacy virus, but if it does, then Beast is probably the most interested in that.
I think it does, because I think Wolverine ends up getting it and then curing it. But that might have been...
Well, yeah, he's got the...
That might be another so virus.
This is a fun thing about the show, is the expositionary dialogue is in full effect for a huge chunk of this show. Insofar as Storm might as well be in a Super Sentai show, because she has to call out every single thing that she does when she is doing it.
I adore that she does it. Because she's
I love it, because wins. She puts on the full theater. She puts on the full theater, but yeah, no, it's very, very funny. But there are all these lines that sound so weird, but you know they're just delivering facts to kids who may not have seen the X-Men or read the comics before. And so they'll say, like, you know, oh, well, you know, what's a good one? Oh, my powers don't work without the sunlight, you know, and stuff like that. Or I think it's a while before they mention Wolverine's healing factor.
They mention it, and they use like, even you can't heal this quickly. But then he'll get hit even harder in another episode, and he'll be fine standing up and stretching out. Like, they didn't really know what to do. Another thing, and I don't know whether this is a choice from the comics or whether this was just a choice for the show, it seems like half the time when Wolverine had his gloves off, he still got the three things on his hands where the claws come out.
That is a thing that's in the comics.
Okay.
Depending on the artist and the story, they kind of come and go with that. In the 90s, it was pretty much always there, and that and there were even scenes where, like, the gloves actually go, like, have slits that go that cover the metal things, so the metal things are actually on his arm.
It's also the claws come out of the tops of his hands, and nowadays we're used to, like, the X-Men movies, the Hugh Jackman coming between the knuckles, which,
yeah,
honestly, I think is kind of cooler, but you know,
I mean, I'm fine either way. You also have the fact that every time he pops out his claws, like, there's a spring of electricity.
So
because he does a cross thing, and it has like this like blast that comes out.
Let's talk about the sound in this show, because I think this is one of the strengths of the show, is the sound. The Sentinels and their sound effects and their voices are so cool. And they're like processing noises. It's like this sort of thudding kind of, like, I can't recreate it, obviously. It's so cool. The sound effect of Wolverine's claws popping out, which is almost always accompanied by Wolverine's voice actor doing like a rawr kind of thing.
Right.
Works, and especially when you learn, you know, in later iterations, that it hurts every time the claws come out. So of course he's making a noise because it hurts every time they come out, which is fun.
Yeah, that's a key line in the original movie. It's like, does it hurt? And he goes, every time.
Yeah.
There are so many things about the sound effects. You're right, of the mutant powers, like Jubilee's when she does her pyrokinetic stuff. Like, anytime I read the comic, I am hearing those firework noises.
Yeah.
You know, anytime Cyclops does his little blast, I think of like that one sound that happens in the theme song. The theme song, composed by Ron Wasserman, who you might know as the composer of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers theme song.
So there's actually been a lawsuit about this theme song, but we'll talk.
I am well aware. We might, of the lawsuit.
We might talk about that. We might talk about that next week, because I didn't re-listen to the song. I knew about it from years ago, but I haven't revisited
it's,
it.
It's pretty apparent.
Yeah,
it's pretty apparent.
So I do think that Apocalypse in this season is completely punked. It's almost hilarious how terrible Apocalypse is in this, despite the fact that Apocalypse has such a cool design and has such
great design, cool voice.
Great voice work.
The old world will wither away. Like the whole thing, as you see, like the kind of like his vision of the future, like it's, but this is, that's the story of Apocalypse. He always has an incredible build, an incredible look, and then just kind of cut shorts. He's had one good story ever, and that's the Age of Apocalypse. Even when they made him kind of cool in the Krakoan stuff, like, he's had one good story ever. Even his introductory story in the original X-Factor stuff, where he takes Angel and turns him into death.
Which also happens here.
Which happens here, and it's weird. That whole sequence is so funny.
It's funny to me because I like that they introduce Warren Worthington as this rich guy who doesn't want to be a mutant because it will affect his status, and he doesn't want to be different.
I've always wanted to be a normal boy, except with all my millions of dollars and prestige. And
it's funny because Angel is one of the founding members of the X-Men. In the comics.
Correct.
And he is not he is not an X-Men member at all here.
Yeah, neither is Iceman.
Iceman's not in the show at all, is he?
I think he has an episode.
I know that there was some weirdness with the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends cartoon. That there were some rights that were tied up to those characters, so I'm wondering
and
if there was something
why they didn't use him in that. I feel like he appears at least in one episode. Let me just double check. Yes, he appears in one episode, as a former X-Man who quit due to disagreements with Xavier.
Interesting, because that's another thing about this show is that these X-Men seem to be new on the ground, but also seem to have experience. Like maybe
it's weird. Like they're simultaneously his students and also like 40-year-olds.
And they have no other students. I remember this show having way more kids going to the school. And
I think you're mixing it up with other X-Men stuff, and it's in your memory because Jubilee is like the only kid.
She is. And it's wild that she's the only one. Also, the X-Mansion gets destroyed and rebuilt in this season, which I think is very, very funny.
Classic.
It just happens so fast.
I'm trying to think of, like, there are so many things that I wanted to, like, point out in this season. Because, I mean, some of it's funny and some of it is, like, you even had a moment where you're like, since when does Cyclops' powers come from the sun? And,
yeah,
which my reaction was like, always.
I had never heard that before. That was not
frankly,
was a new thing to me.
It only comes up when it's convenient for the story, because it comes up in the Morlock arc, and I think it comes up in the comic as well. But like, this dude goes traveling in space all the time, like, and not always near a star. So it's
so does Superman, and
same complaint counts.
I feel like you get more solar power when you're just out there.
But see, Superman, the solar stuff comes up a lot in the stories. Like, this dude literally went into the subway and lost his abilities.
By the way, I had never clocked that's what happened in that. For years I remember thinking back to this episode and thinking, oh, so one of the Morlocks did something to him to take his powers away, right? No, he's just in the subway. I had never thought about that. Okay, so he's been out of the sunlight for less than a day and he's lost his powers. They're in the danger room all the time. They're literally inside a building with no windows all the time. And Jean has never seen his eyes.
Yeah, it's so silly because, and I mean, this is a thing. I mean, as a fan, it's fun to poke fun at this. Like, in the episodes, I'm generally, like, fine with it. I might kind of, like, huh. But, like, Rogue's powers are, every time she uses them, it's a wildly different thing. Like, she's able to permanently heal Warren, but she holds on to Cyclops, and he's fine for a little bit, and she, you know, absorbs his power for, like, a day, it feels like. And then other times it's like nothing. It's just like, oh, I weakened you.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like she's getting more control over her powers.
Yeah, except the times that it the times don't match up to that.
Well, let's get down to, I think, maybe the most interesting and impactful two-parter of this season. Their take on Days of Future Past.
It's really good.
So these episodes, especially the flash forward to the future, this seems so high quality animation, way mm-hmm. higher quality than anything else in the series so far. And like this is where they're like, we know we have to nail this, so let's get it right.
Yeah, even at the time, that was a very popular, iconic comic book story.
And it looks really, really cool. And it feels a lot like Days of Future Past. We read Days of Future Past on this podcast 2 years ago, 3 years ago, four mm-hmm. years ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago. despite the fact that Kitty Pryde is not a member of the process, weirdly, they were going to send Wolverine back, which is very much a, like, isn't that what they did
in the movie?
What they did in the movie, which is very funny, very wild. But yeah, you've got this sort of like bombed out look at things, and there are flashes of other stuff that happened. So we see that we see the iconic gravestones of the X-Men, and you see, you know, who did a better job than anybody else. Like Cyclops died in 2032. You know, he did okay. Wolverine, in comparison,
not dead.
Wolverine, not dead.
And which I was a little disappointed that you don't get the classic, like, him getting blasted by the Sentinel and like the whole metal skeleton comes out. Well, because you see Forge with the metal skeleton in what looks like a Bacta tank. So like Wolverine's like healing himself, but it was a bummer not to get that moment. That's one of the most iconic moments from the entire series, other than, I think, him being crucified on a big X.
Yeah, you know.
What's wild about this entire show, but especially this specific set of episodes, but when this sequel show was announced, in our kindergarten American politic times, a certain set of people started complaining that the series had gone quote unquote woke. And I'm like, anyone saying something that stupid, one, has never read, watched, or understood the X-Men. But you watch socially and politically conscious this show is in the first season. Like, the entire thing is very political.
There's a female president in this season of the X-Men cartoon. Like the X-Men have always been a civil rights allegory. Always. Yeah. Always. The fact that anybody would argue that that has not been the case have not been reading X-Men comics.
No, and really they just want to complain per their agenda. They have no actual good faith argument to make.
Yeah.
But I don't like bringing that kind of stuff up in our show often, but like this show is very, very apparent in the kind of message it's sending about things. And you can't not bring it up.
So I want to say a couple of things about that. One, this show made me dislike Cyclops for a long time. Yeah. Until I read comic Cyclops and realized, oh, this guy,
he's always sucked.
No, I like comic Cyclops.
It depends. It depends on the arc, because there are some eras of Cyclops that I cannot stand.
Cyclops in Civil War? That dude's cool in Civil War.
Yeah. Cyclops in that weird thing where he like sides with Magneto and is like a terrorist for a little bit, but like not for good reasons. It's really weird.
It's like Cyclops in the comics is a dude who believes in mutant rights and believes in Professor Xavier, but in this show is just a dweeb. He's a dweeb, and
he is a dweeb.
I don't like it.
And despite how cool he looks, like you have to have someone playing that kind of character, and which is why I think so many people like love Wolverine and Gambit, despite the fact that they're already cool characters, but they're always at odds with Cyclops and his boring rules.
Yes, yes. The other thing I was going to say is going back to the Days of Future Past thing, Nimrod. So Miles, this has been a known thing, you know, in social media circles. When's the first time you ever heard the name Nimrod?
I mean, probably X-Men comics.
See, for me, it was Looney Tunes cartoons.
Where, oh, you know what? Yeah, when Bugs and Buddy called Elmer Fudd a Nimrod. Yeah,
and it's funny that because that was, I had heard it there. And this was back in the 90s, so I'd never gotten an explanation of who Nimrod was. And so I'm hearing
that it's actually a super like smart person joke that no one got.
It's been kind of a known thing that Bugs Bunny changed the definition of what a Nimrod was by, or who Nimrod was, by using it ironically in talking to Elmer Fudd, which is hilarious. Like Nimrod is a mythologically great hunter. That's what Nimrod was
in the Bible. I think he was a big hunter.
So you know, it's funny for Bugs Bunny to call Elmer Fudd Nimrod because he's not a great hunter. But then then like the next year when this super killer crazy powerful sentinel is named after the Elmer Fudd joke because that's who it was in my head. Cause I was, you know, 8 when this show came out.
Right. And I mean, cause he was a mutant hunter, but I think the legacy of that joke is that it became a word for moron. And especially I think at the second generation of kids who watched that without a lot of the background that maybe the intended audience is supposed to have, but like when I grew up that word, I assumed it was synonymous with moron.
Yeah, but I'm saying that's not the word you want associated with your super powerful sentinel.
Well, no, I mean, but that's just what happened. Like,
yeah.
What I'm saying is I think it took time for that joke to fall as flat as it did, because I feel like it was our generation that picked up on that, not the initial generation.
Probably.
I'm saying 5 years later, it's the title of a Green Day record, and they mean that as to mean like moron or idiot.
Right, because this is what I'm saying. Like it was what it was by the time, you know, we were growing up. Like people, kids watching this cartoon knew the Bugs Bunny definition. They didn't know the actual definition.
Right.
But anyway, Nimrod went out so fast. I remember him being a much bigger deal in this episode, and he went out in 2 seconds, and it was pretty.
He has gone on to be a bigger pain in the neck for the X-Men.
Yes, and also his arc in Powers of X, the recent Krakoa run, was super interesting. Mm-hmm. Super interesting. Anyway, we're kind of running out of steam on episodes.
Well, we're just kind of bouncing around.
We are. We're bouncing around like the X-Men do all over the planet, as they go back and forth from New York to Scotland and back in a single episode.
Was there anything here that you found, I don't want to say didn't hold up, that's not the kind of phrase, but is there stuff where like when you went back to revisit it, you're like, oh, this doesn't work as well for me now?
Yes, I think there's a decent bit that doesn't hold up, and I hate to say that, but it's true, because so much of this stuff is surface level. Like I remember specifically, you know, like Magneto talks a lot about his background and where I'm from. I watched them do this and watch them do that to people. And they don't go far enough in saying.
No, they just say he was from a war-torn fictional country, as opposed to saying he was a Holocaust survivor. And like there had no, I'm glad you brought this up, because there's been a meme recently where it's like Professor X made him relive the Holocaust. Nope. He did not.
Did not.
He made him relive the war, but this is not World War II. This is some other fictional country where, like, basically, yeah, they were, you know, being oppressed, but it was not the same thing. And I think that takes a lot of the power of Magneto's perspective away.
Yes.
Because
Magneto's whole perspective is kind of skewed anyway. Like, he wants to start a war, but I don't really know why.
Also, look, like, he might be right, or he at least might have a point in certain avenues, but he's also a militant narcissist who is a little trigger happy. Like, there's a lot of avenues to old Magneto. But that, I mean, that's certainly something that I totally agree with you on. I think they do drop the ball on some of these characters. Magneto was one of them. They still make him feel too much like he's an old supervillain. Like, I don't know how else to put it, but it feels like he's from a different decade.
Yeah.
In a sense. Like, it's a Magneto from like the 1970s. Because he's just kind of goofy. in a way, and I don't know what it is. And then, I mean, they kind of redeem the character in the latter half of the season, but it's weird on the things that they do drop the ball on. It's one of those shows that, like, it feels like it gets as much right as it doesn't, but at the same time, in the context of 1992, this was still pretty legendary. Like, there wasn't a lot of character development in American animation in 1992 on your Saturday morning cartoons.
Sure.
Like,
I think
it's important to note that, not as to give it a pass, but to note that this was particularly interesting at the time because it was the first show on a major, like, platform. And I think this is around the time of, like, Pirates of Dark Water, so I can't even bring that one up. But that was pushing a constant narrative. That was it felt like a grown-up cartoon.
Well, and not only that, but you have character development that happens and to main characters, which is just like Rogue especially has kind of a character arc. It's maybe feels a little too fast for adult me in 2024, but
like, at the time when you only had 13 episodes and you were watching this week to week,
it's pretty good. Like,
it is pretty good. And you know, it was one of those things I remember watching when you're watching the X-Men show, and I think this is why people sometimes chase that, like, oh, I want my comic book stuff to be mature and dark and edgy, is because, like, the X-Men was mature, and it was probably the first mature-themed show that a lot of kids our age had exposure to, and it came on at 11 o'clock. It was the last show of the Saturday morning block, which was right before all the adult live-action stuff.
Speaking of mature stuff, we didn't even talk about the fact that one of the characters dies in the first episode.
Oh, the character they made for the show, you mean.
The character they made for the show, Morph, who will be back in the new... So I guess he didn't stay dead for long. But yeah, Morph dies. You then hear his voice actor playing every third background character in the series.
But it's so funny from Night in the Sentinels, the My Fellow Americans, I Am an Idiot, has like stayed in my head since 1992.
What has stayed in my head is more so laugh that he does. Like,
yeah, he was a cool character. That, I mean, I remember being bummed out that he passed away, and then when the Age of Apocalypse comes around and there's this new character, oh, it turns out they brought Morph into the comics.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, I don't know if he's been brought into the 616 universe or not, but like, he was a major part of Age of Apocalypse and was a great character.
Yeah, I've never read Age of Apocalypse. I should probably do that. So, I also haven't read... I also haven't read House of Wind.
Because there's like a lot of build-up stuff, and some of it you don't need to read and can be really, really boring. But the event itself, pretty incredible.
Well, we'll see. Maybe later in the year, maybe next year. We're going to be pretty X'd out, I think, by the end of this month. But yeah, final thoughts, season one, X-Men, the animated series.
I think it's worth a visit. I think it's really interesting to see how much they took from the comics. And I mean, you kind of get to see the birth of a legend in a sense, because like how we look at the X-Men. And I mean, this really does go back to Jim Lee's artwork in X-Men number one. I think how we think of the X-Men, how we remember the X-Men, and where the X-Men go from here, even in the comics, are all a result of the cultural impact of this show. And maybe not the first season necessarily in some aspects, but there is so much as a comic book fan that they take that, like, if you were to go into your comic shop, you have an idea of who the main characters are. Even if it's a different team, you have an idea of who these people are and whose stories that were told. Because if you went to the comic shop and got a trade for Days of Future Past, okay, it's not the same story, but it is very similar. And that kind of similarity is something we don't get a lot of. Everyone wants to put a twist on it now.
Yeah.
As opposed to like getting a pretty decent in terms of like the spirit of the comic. You couldn't get closer than X-Men the Animated Series,
and
despite any of its faults.
And honestly, I've got to say, this is something that's happening in 1992. 32 years ago, this is happening. That they were putting this amount of thought into comic book stories aimed at kids that long ago, that is a testament to itself.
Yeah.
Does it 100%
with Batman the Animated Series? Really?
Does it 100% land everything it's trying to do? No. Does it get close enough? Yeah, it really does. There are fewer misses than hits in this season. I'm almost wondering if this season had been 20 episodes or 22 episodes or whatever instead of 13, would we have better character development going even deeper into these character development things, or would it just be too drawn out and too slow and too boring? And that's a question I just don't have the answer to.
I think you do, because I think like a huge chunk of these were commissioned around the same time, so you know they were doing the same thing, so they would have kept going. I think you would have gotten what you get in season two, but I still don't think they would have been thinking about character development as much. I mean, even Batman the Animated Series, as much as we love that show, kind of reset most of the weeks.
Batman the Animated Series, fantastic, fantastic. Best
top tier.
Best cartoon show about superheroes ever for on TV. But it was very episodic. So,
yeah.
Where this one really wasn't in a way that I was not expecting.
And it's wild because like I think every X-Men cartoon since, which is only two of them, Wolverine the X-Men and X-Men Evolution, have been that way. They don't have like, you know, I'm sure they have some Monster of the Week kind of episodes, for lack of a better word, but like they're always telling an ongoing arc. And I think that has something deeply to do with the soap opera nature of the X-Men.
Yeah.
Same with Spider-Man, and why they did very similar with his animated series. Spider-Man, very much a soap opera.
Really is. So gang, that is going to be the end of our season one episode. And of course, what are we doing? We're going to cover season two next week. Season two, similar to season one, is only 13 episodes, and Miles and I are going to try to watch the entire thing. But the episodes we're going to focus on is six episodes. There's a two-parter, Till Death Do Us Part, parts one and two. Oh yeah, because this season ends with Scott and Jean getting engaged. So we're going to get the wedding of Cyclops and Jean Grey in the opening two-parter. There is a two-part Cable and Bishop time travel two-parter that's Time Fugitives parts 1 and 2. That's episodes 7 and 8. And then we have Reunion, which is another Mr. Sinister two-parter that is episodes 12 and 13, the final two episodes of the season. Mr. Sinister is supposed to be a big part of the new X-Men 97 series as sort of the big bad. So this is where we're really going to get started with Sinister stories. So that's going to be next week.
I'm excited to get to it.
Me too, because man, this show is really something, and I'm
having a great time. I mean, I've always been a huge X-Men fan, like almost as much as a Batman fan, but like I forget like how much I love this show, and so it's been really fun to revisit this for the first time in a very long time.
All right, gang. Well, if you would like to reach out to us, you can find us at themoreyounerd.com, which is has this and every other episode we've ever done going back more than a decade of nerd goodness. You can tweet to us at themoreyounerd, facebook.com/themoreyounerd, Blue Sky at themoreyounerd. Message us on Blue Sky so that we know that you're out there and we'll maybe post something. And of course, you can email us themoreyounerd@gmail.com. That's themoreyounerd@gmail.com. Also, Miles and I are cast members on another show called Cosmic Crit, which is an actual play podcast for the Starfinder role-playing game by Paizo. It's a very fun show, and you can catch all of our adventures over at cosmiccrit.com. You can also find a link to the Cosmic Crit Discord, where if you join that, you can talk to me and Miles all the time.
Yep, yep, yep.
So do that, because we'd love to see you and talk to you. So in the meantime, gang, we are going to end the show as we always do with a rousing nerd out.
Two nerd for y'all.